Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we look back at some of the best features we aired in 2007. We learn about the local Grammy Award-winning record label, Archaeophone. We talk to a man who has created a beer that tastes like pizza. And we find out about downtown Champaign's drinking fraternity. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. In April, Jeff Bossert profiled the Grammy-winning record label Archaeophone, located in Champaign. They pride themselves on finding recordings from around 100 years ago. When Jeff did his story, Archaeophone had just released a collection of music from World War I.
One of the first World War I protest songs was written by the ordinarily patriotic Irving Berlin. Recorded in 1915 by Henry Burr, "Stay Down Here Where You Belong" has the devil warning his son to stay in hell and avoid the war on earth, because the folks up above don't know right from wrong.
To please their king, they've all gone out to war, and not a one of them knows what he's fighting for.
The song is one of 56 recordings on The Great War, a two-disc set on Archaeophone Records. It was actually one of the first collections envisioned by label founders Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy 7 years ago. But Richard says they really didn't know what they were doing.
We put out 3 CDs at the time, and we're still trying to find our voice. And so it took us that long to figure out how we wanted to do this.
While compiling 32 more releases the last few years, the husband and wife team continually revisited the approach for a World War I collection. Martin says ideas range from a set of songs the Doughboys sang, profiling the most popular hits among the military, to a history lesson, analyzing a large number of songs from the period and their lyrics.
That was a little too much high school English class. So what we ended up realizing needed to be done, had never been done before, was to tell the story of the industry, the recording industry, the role it played in helping to sell the war. And that was the gold mine.
Martin says many at that time failed to take the phonograph seriously, considering it more of a toy around 1916. That's the year Woodrow Wilson narrowly won the presidential election with a platform of avoiding the war effort. But a year later, he reluctantly committed the U.S. military after negotiations with Germany fell through. Wilson not only enlisted Congress to finance a buildup of troops, but created a campaign of Americanism by starting up a new federal agency to not only promote the war domestically, but to question the loyalty of German immigrants. The Committee for Public Information, or CPI, was basically a propaganda network of public speakers, advertisers, film, and other media. But Director George Creel, an investigative journalist and politician, didn't seek out the recording industry. Record companies responded to the snub by producing a publicity campaign of their own to get troops ready for the trip overseas. Archaeophone's Megan Hennessy.
They recognized very early on that there was so much interest in the war that they should be selling product about it, because people didn't have news like they do now. This was how they got it. And store owners would say, you know, you got to set up a war display. People want to hear it. Whenever I put on the national anthems of countries at war, people come and stand and hang out in my shop. And they realized it was good for business.
A long, lean country gig from way out west, where the hops don't wait. He was 6 feet two and his stockings feet.
One recruitment song, released in 1917, used lighthearted humor in an attempt to gain acceptance of the U.S. entry into the war. Long Boy was recorded by Byron G. Harlan with the Peerless Quartet.
Hey, goodbye, Ma, goodbye, Pa, goodbye, Mule, with your old hee-haw. I'm
may not know what the war's about, but you bet by gosh I'll soon find out. And oh, my sweetheart, don't you fear, I'll bring you a...
This song has a personal connection for a teacher and record collector who collaborated on the CD project.
That's my grandpa. That's him. He put away the mule, he took care of the cow, and he went downtown and he stood in line with the rest of the draftees and went to war.
Clarence O. Johnson says when he was 4 or 5, his grandfather, Clarence D. Johnson, would sit him on his knee and recall stories of serving in France during the First World War, having been drafted into the Army just weeks after graduating from high school. Johnson says his grandfather didn't achieve any military honors, but for him, it was a matter of doing what the government asked.
To the day of his death, 92, I'm sure he could have told you every step of every day that he spent in the forest. Sometimes couldn't remember what he had for lunch, but he could remember the forest. He told me within 2 weeks of his dying that he still woke up reaching for the dead man in the foxhole.
Johnson, a high school and college English teacher in Dallas, says his studies illuminated what his grandfather was all about before and after the war. Archaeophone's release of The Great War is dedicated to the memory of Clarence D. Johnson. Just prior to 1917 and the U.S. military effort, there were war protest songs that were essentially lost with the message marketed by the government. Megan Hennessy says another selection on their CD set incorporated humor to voice its disapproval of the German occupation of the Western Front.
One of the ones that actually is interesting the more you hear it is War Talk at Pumpkin Center. Cal Stewart did rural comedy, spoken word routines, and this was set back in the day after the Belgian atrocities were going on, and all the men folk in Pumpkin Center are complaining about the fact that they can't get any sewing done because the women are making clothing for the Belgians. It's really unusual.
Around with my pants held up with a 10-penny nail and a clothespin and a flag of truce fluttering from the rear while my wife and gals is sewing for Belgians. I made up a song about it. I'll shut down the melodeon, see if I can sing it for you. All the folks at our house are busy as can be, sewing for them Belgians what live across the sea. I've got nothing left to wear, not much between me and the air. If I grumble, they don't care. Gosh, I wish I was a Belgian. Gosh, I wish I was a Belgian.
For the last portion of the Archaeophone release, the recordings begin to reflect the reality of war and the aftermath with soldiers who didn't return home. World War I was labeled the Great War because many believe it was responsible for changing Europe forever. The recording industry began to recognize the impact on the U.S. in the 1920s. Richard Martin describes the very last track on the set, My Dream of the Big Parade, recorded in 1926 by the Peerless Quartet with Billy Murray.
Imagine this dream that the singer is having of seeing a photo play on his wall, and it's this parade of these returning veterans, you know, gassed and wounded, and you know, Gold Star mothers and things like that. And it's very critical, very haunting. And you have the idea then, full circle, that you know, what did we do this for? What was the reason?
Last night I was dreaming of days that are gone, of days that you might recall. And just like a photoplay upon my wall, once more I saw it all. It was just a...
The Great War, an American musical fantasy, is the first in a new grouping of CDs from Archaeophone called the Critical Issues Series, featuring vintage recordings tied to major historical events. I'm Jeff Bossert.
In my dream of the big
parade,
I saw angels there with the red cross there. In my dream of the big parade, I saw Gold Star mothers, sisters and brothers. What a sacrifice they made. I saw
one-legged pals coming home to their cows in my dream of the peace.
You're listening to Sidetrack. This last summer marked Star Wars' 30th anniversary. Star Wars fandom reaches to all corners of the globe. There's a group of fans who like to spend their time dressed up like stormtroopers and other members of the evil empire. They're called the 501st Legion, and they have chapters called garrisons all over the world. One member of the Midwest Garrison is Jim DeJan of Forest, Illinois. I talked with him for the June program and asked him to first explain what the 501st Legion is.
10 years ago, gentleman from South Carolina by the name of Alvin Johnson and a friend of his thought it would be a lot of fun to build themselves stormtrooper costumes excuse me, and go to a premiere. He then posted pictures from that on a website, and other people started sending pictures of them doing the same thing. So all of a sudden, there was this influx of mindset of people building stormtrooper armor, mainly from styrene or from ABS plastics, by hand, you know, in vacuum form for the most part. Which means you have to build a form, you then have to refine it, then you have to heat the plastic to push over the form, and a great deal of work and time and effort. And he found that people were doing this everywhere, so to the point that this being our 10th anniversary, we now have close to 4,000 members worldwide.
Yeah, I was looking on the 501st Legion website, and you have these garrisons all over the place in Europe and South America and, of course, in
Singapore.
The U.S. It's amazing how you can get guys around the world to dress up like stormtroopers. And I guess it's not just guys and girls.
The guys and gals, we have what we call our femties or femtroopers. The gals, let's face it, you really can't tell the sex of the trooper until they take their helmet off. So they enjoy it just as much as we do.
Now, how do you describe this? Is it dress up? Is it reenactment? Is it costuming? What I'm searching for the proper term.
It starts with costuming, the love of building costumes. I myself and my wife have been costuming since we were in our 20s. I'm 54 now, it just generated to the point where the maker, George Lucas, created Star Wars 30 years ago this year, this week, and gave us a whole raft of a wealth of characters to portray.
Now, this 501st Legion, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's mostly the evil empire, people dressing up like the stormtroopers. They're not the good guys.
No, we're not. they can't shoot worth a darn either. It's pretty much basically the bad guys, mainly because we like to have some fun, and the fun being doing things for charity in our local areas and showing that bad guys can be good. There is a very iconic thing with Darth Vader coming into a room, especially, for the sake of it, a birthday party we did in Gibson City couple of weekends ago. Lord Vader comes through the door, and all you see are these saucer eyes of these little children looking up at him, and he stands about 6'2" or 6'4" in our local area here. He's in Champaign, in fact, a gentleman by the name of Chip, and this was his first day, his first outing as Vader, and he pulled it off spectacularly. Myself, I dress as a TIE pilot, which is also in black and gets mistaken for Vader once in a while. But we're working on that little costume recognition. We had Boba Fett. We had several troopers. So it was a great thing for this little young 5-year-old or so to have these people have come to his party.
In the movie universe of Star Wars, if you had the Darth Vader and all the stormtroopers come into your birthday party, I think that would be a bad sign.
Yeah, they'd be all packed up and set off to the spice mines of Kessel. But for the most part, we're there to have fun with the kids, and we don't charge for doing it. In fact, what we ask them to do is, for the most part, make a donation in the Legion's name to their favorite charity. Most of the time, it's Make-A-Wish. We do not accept gratuities. You want to feed us, that's okay, but it's a very daunting task to get all this gear on, especially if it's a day like today and close to 90 degrees and you're wearing black. It's not the most fun thing to do. But if you're walking into, say, a hospital and the children's ward, which we've done any number of times, you've never seen a trooper cry until you've seen these guys at the end of an event like that. It's the joy that we give them, that they see the figures, the action, walking action figures, as we've been described as, walk through the door to them and treat them with respect and love and caring. And that all comes really basically from our founder, Alvin, again. There is a movie, if you don't mind me plugging it.
No, go right ahead.
It's a fan film, fan-made film called Heart of an Empire. In fact, you can find it online. It's heartoftheempire.com. It's been, it has debuted finally this last month or so, and it's going around to different film festivals. And unlike Trekkies and the like, this tells the true story of how Albin and others in the Legion have stepped up to take care of not only others, but the Legion has taken care of its own. Albin lost a very sweet child to a terrible illness, and it brought the Legion together as a group. And since then, we've been doing things to take care of our own, people who have been burned out of their homes, injuries and so on. And it's the camaraderie, the fun of getting together with an interest and a love of Star Wars to go out and have fun in public. The over 300 and some of them are out in California for Celebration 4 in L.A. this past weekend. And what'd they do? They went out and had fun with their friends. And that's the whole reason we do it. Have some fun. Keeps me young, keeping up with these youngsters, these 20 and 30-year-olds with young families. It's a stitch, so which is why I usually end up driving the float at a parade instead of walking it.
Now, I'm always curious about movie fans who take that step, that big step of not just watching the movie or enjoying it, but to dress up as characters from those movies.
Talking to an old Klingon here, so just watch it, okay? we do have lives, okay? Most of these people, these kids, I call them kids because I've probably got about 20 years on most of them, are professionals, are policemen, are lawyers, are doctors. Majority of you couldn't afford to build these costumes without being gainfully employed. So it's not like they all live in their mother's basement. I'm sorry. Bill Shatner didn't always get it right, you know.
Well, I guess my question is, what is that threshold between being the person who enjoys the movie and then going out and saying, I want to make myself a costume to embody one of the characters?
I think it's also the journey of building. It's a creative outlet to be as screen accurate as you can possibly be, to do the research, although most of us have done the research and we pass the information along to the newbies, as we call them. And it's the joy of, you know, showing the pride somebody gets when he brings out his costume, his or her costume for the first time. And people go, ooh, ah, over it. That's the thrill. There's nothing wrong, you know. like that feeling of being impressing people with it. Now, sure, there are going to be people that are totally freaked, but I can't count on them. You know, it's not that's not why we do it. We do it for ourselves, for the enjoyment of doing it. And the fact that we have other people who enjoy doing it with us just makes it all that much better.
That was Jim DeJan. He's a member of the 501st Legion, a group of very devoted Star Wars fans. This is Sidetrack. Most of us couldn't think of life without television, but for essayist Deb Aronson, living in a TV-less world came by accident, an accident she is now grateful for.
My family mourned the death of our television. It was a lingering illness, and we took no heroic measures. Still, we hoped against hope for a miracle cure. Every once in a while, one of us would wander over and stab at the buttons, hoping for some sign of life. Alas, by the end, there was none. Not even a little static. The entertainment center became a mausoleum. In the following weeks, however, peace and quiet reigned in our house. Personally, I felt no particular love of the television. When it was around, the television's incessant chatter was like having an ill-mannered house guest who doesn't take the clue that it is time to leave. Every dinner was a battle to get the kids away from their favorite show or advertisement and come to the table. My husband would stay up until all hours watching whatever he might find as he mindlessly flitted from channel to channel. I didn't mean to never get another television, but I didn't run right out and buy a new one either. The thought crossed my mind that an extended break might be just what we all needed. I learned later that the kids thought we couldn't afford a new television. Why else wouldn't we have replaced it immediately? Why, indeed? It turns out there are lots of reasons. The whole family started to go to bed at a more reasonable hour, which made us all more pleasant in the morning. Getting everyone to the dinner table was no longer a battle. Our son, who was in second grade at the time, turned to books. The children bickered less. We had full-fledged conversations. Still, sometimes, late at night, after the children were asleep, my husband and I would whisper in the dark about missing our favorite shows and whether we could somehow get a television and the kids wouldn't notice. But really, once the television was gone, we just didn't miss it as much as we thought we would. Once you get out of the habit, it becomes surprisingly easy to not worry so much about any of your favorite characters. You remember that they are just actors, not your pals. And my husband and I agreed that the benefits far outweighed our temporary withdrawal symptoms. I am not and don't intend to become an anti-television evangelist, but I am a fan of simplicity. Why do things or have things that drive us crazy? And the television drove me crazy, like toxic love. Maybe it drove everyone in my family crazy, but they didn't realize until it was gone. People's reactions to our TV-less state have surprised me. Usually, it starts with my confessing that we don't have a television when someone refers to some recent advertisement or television show. They look at me with what seems like awe, but maybe it is shock. Many people shake their heads and say, "I should really do that," or "I could never do that," a bit wistfully, as if they could glimpse the promised land, but knew it was not for them. It's tempting to lay a real guilt trip on these people. They seem to be asking for one. Instead, I overcompensate the other way. "Oh, you know, we didn't do it on purpose. It just sort of happened. It's no big deal, really." And it is not a big deal. It's not like we climbed Mount Everest or cured cancer. But then I realize that that is the nature of toxic love. The toxic part is intertwined with the love part, making it difficult to leave in the case of a person, or discard in the case of a television. And in the case of television, is television really all that toxic? What, come to think about it, do I hate about television? Recently, we spent a weekend in St. Louis. We stayed in a hotel, the one place, other than at their grandparents, the kids have unfettered access to a television. And I think I figured out what I hate about the boob tube. It's that glazed zombie stare the kids adopt when they have the television on. It is as if the body snatchers have come for them. If I try to talk to the kids, they don't make eye contact. Their jaws are slack. I can practically see their brains withering. There is not even a way to pause the action and check that they are still alive in there. The only movement is the twitch of their fingers, flipping through the channels. In Ray Bradbury's novel, Fahrenheit 451, people's lives are absorbed by enormous televisions, which, ideally, take up all four walls of the living room and are referred to as parlor walls. Front porches and sidewalks are gone because people spend all their free time in front of their parlor walls with an artificial family played by actors. I'm not saying we're there as a culture yet, but sometimes I feel like we're getting close. Personally, I'd rather keep my front porch, my sidewalks, and my family. And when I weigh that against having a glowing, chattering box that turns my kids into drooling zombies, well, I don't feel so bad about leaving the television dead and buried.
Deb Aronson lives in Urbana with her family and without a television. That essay came from the May program. Still to come on this Best of 2007 program, we find out why someone would want to create a beer that tastes like pizza. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. If you stop by Indiana University South Bend and see students napping, don't worry. They're probably members of the Nap Club. It's a student club devoted to midday naps. The group was founded by students Joe Spencer and Michael Duttlinger. I talked with the two of them for the March program and first asked Spencer how the Nap Club got started and what the club is all about.
Well, I was talking to Mike here, and he wanted to get involved in the campus a little bit more. And I've been involved in various things here for a while, and he asked me for suggestions. He didn't really want to be part of student government, and so I suggested that he start a club. And he goes, well, what kind of club should I start? And I go, well, what do you like to do? And he said, sleep. We laughed about that a bit, and I said, well, start a sleeping club. Why don't you? And we just kind of joked with that for about a week or so. Then as the joking went on, we got more and more serious about this and realized the benefits that a nap club could bring to the campus. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So one day, shortly after lunch, we just sat down, we wrote the Constitution, and then we went around to different professors, and we got Professor Olson, who's the head of sociology, to be our faculty advisor. We filled out the paperwork the next day, and we were a real club.
So is this what you expected, Mike?
It is what I expected. I didn't expect it to get nearly this big. I thought we'd just, you know, be local campus, but it's taken off. We got an article in the school paper because they basically needed filler for a issue. So they said, you can do it on us. And South Bend Tribune saw it, and then the rest is just kind of went on from there.
So tell me the basics about the nap club, Mike. Do you have an official nap room? What do you guys do to facilitate napping?
We don't have an official room. The campus can't, like, reserve a room for the entire semester for us, so we have to reserve a room every week. And we just basically on Thursday or Friday, like, hey, we need a room for next week, and they give it to us. And what we do, we provide the people there with air mattresses that they can use, and we also wake them up on time, kind of like a wake-up service so they don't miss class.
Are there any rules to the nap club? Like, you know, Fight Club, with the first rule of nap club is you don't talk about nap club? I mean, what's the rules there?
First rule of nap club is you don't talk during nap club.
And yes. That's about it.
As long as you're not disruptive to the other people, that's pretty much the only rule.
Now, Joe, what do people say to you and Mike when you tell them you have founded a club that is about napping?
They usually give a weird look at first, and then they kind of blow it off, and then I'm kind of like, well, no, it's a real club. This is what we do. And then people will, like, some people will give me, oh, napping is great. I heard such and such a little fact about napping. And a variety of comments, but I think most people think it's a great idea, especially the professors on campus love the idea of a nap club, and they tell their classes about it.
And what are your peak hours, and, you know, how many people join you during the course of the day?
It varies. We offer this from 11 to 3, Monday through Thursday. There's very few classes on Fridays, but basically any time the people can get there, they're welcome to show up and just drop in. Usually we'll have about 2 or 3 people there at a time, and as people leave, more people come.
And it's just people napping. Nothing more than that.
Simple as that.
You mentioned earlier, Mike, that you guys have gotten a lot of press. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that people have caught on to this idea of what you guys are doing?
Because it's such a simple idea, and that, like, no one's really organized it before that well. I think this is just something novel that people have picked up.
You guys seem so busy now, because I've seen a lot of articles online about this and such. Have you guys had a chance to nap at all recently?
Not recently. We've been busy, like, calling people, sending emails and stuff, but it's, you know, we welcome the publicity.
Now, this nap club, it reminds me a lot of kindergarten. You know, when you're young, you'd play and then take a nap, and then you'd have juice and cookies. Now, is there a juice and cookie club in the works to compliment you? Or just nap?
Just nap. I think we're going to keep it at just the nap club. If another student wants to start the cookies and juice club, we'll think about doing some events together. I don't think we have any interest in starting another semi-related club.
Yeah, we're keeping this free of charge for all the nappers. And if we started adding food and other things, we didn't have to charge.
Well, you guys have really hit on an idea here. Have you ever thought about franchising it? Or have people talked to you about maybe doing this in other campuses around the country?
There's some people who are very interested on different, like, college campuses. So I assume that people will start forming them after they read the article in other campuses.
And this might be a business plan for you guys as well. You ever think about that, doing this maybe professionally as a new enterprise?
I don't think we've joked about it, but we know where that goes, but we don't know.
What's in the future for the Nap Club? What do you guys got planned in the near term?
Nothing definite, really. We kind of joke that we should have field trips to, like, a Sealy store or someplace where they make mattresses, as kind of joking, which could actually happen or could possibly not, depending on what happens.
Well, you could get sponsorship from a mattress company.
We haven't right now. I think we're pretty set with everything that we think we need. We're going to have to upgrade our mattresses eventually. And we may be getting some club T-shirts to pass around.
So if anybody wants to learn more about what you guys do with the Nap Club, is there a place they can go? Is there a website?
Anybody can shoot us an email at iusbnapclub@gmail.com.
That was Joe Spencer and Michael Duttlinger, founders of the Nap Club at Indiana University, South Bend. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Yale has Skull and Bones, Cornell has the Quill and Dagger, and Champaign has its own invitation-only society, Pi Omega Omega, the Downtown Drinking Fraternity. Selective but not elitist, Pi Omega Omega's members include everyone from dishwashers to graduate students, babies to bar owners. The only common points are a sense of humor, a nickname, and a meeting with the President Moose. From the April program, here's the story of Pi Omega Omega from Sidetrack's Matt Kessler.
I would like to say that 98% of this bar has a frat name.
Hi, my name's Mike. My frat name is Hooker. I live in Champaign and I'm a graduate student.
My name is Ryan Double Down Walker.
My name is George, and my frat name is Jungle. We had actually looked up in a dictionary that Jungle is actually from the Swahili Jungala. And so sometimes I go by Jungala.
The youngest frat member ever was named in utero. Babies in utero don't drink.
So much of the stuff is just kind of inside jokes that started between a couple of people in the frat, and nobody else really knows what the inside joke is, but they just kind of pick up on it and run with it. Kind of like chicken. Chicken.
The frat is Pi Omega Omega.
Pi Omega Omega is P-O-O, or...
poo.
The downtown frat is a mockery of the rather large Greek system at the University of Illinois. At least it started that way, and now it's more of just a nonsensical kind of big, huge inside joke that everyone is in on.
Frat is the downtown drinking culture community.
Mostly people who are industry workers, people who work restaurant, bars, things like that, people in the know.
It's a way to figure out who's the insiders and who's the outsiders.
I think that Pi Omega Omega and the word fraternity are usually not used in the same context. They don't really strive to be a quote-unquote fraternity in the sense that most people would associate terms with a fraternity. I think that they would strive to be a fraternity in the actual definition of the word. Like, if you need a shoulder, you got it. If you need a place to crash, you've got it. If something happened today that is really horrible, then, you know, hey, you can tell me about it, and we'll see what we can do to get through this, you know, and a few pints. I think that Pi Omega Omega actually embodies every good aspect of a fraternity.
Champaign, to me, is a college town that would be very uninteresting if not for the college, but at the same time, I personally dislike it revolving completely around the University of Illinois.
A regular frat, if somebody would say fraternity to me, the first thing I would think is a backwards hat, probably a trucker hat, you know, designer clothing, wasted talent with my parents' money sort of organization. The drinking fraternity, on the other hand, I think is more of like a working class, like, you know, it's like a working man's fraternity. Everybody that's in the fraternity has a job, and most of them work well over 40 hours a week.
The frat is very diverse. We've got professionals, we've got dishwashers, and we've got everybody in between. You know, other than the frat itself, there's no, like, single thread that ties everybody together, except that they know our president, Barney, or Moose, I should say.
I was not in on the beginnings of the frat. It started about 10 years ago. Moose was one of the founders, Moose.
Moose, the president of Pi Omega, came in one night after a bout of drinking and socializing with other folks and told me that he had a dream.
Not that I'm comparing Moose to Buddha, but I must say that he has a very unique sense of humor that I think that we could all benefit from.
I was in his dream. I don't remember what all was happening in the dream, but I didn't know him very well, and he came in hardly able to stand up, walked right up to me and said, "Double Down. You are in my dream. Your name is Double Down."
My name is Moose. It was 10 years ago. A roommate and I were just sitting in our room, and basically we were always hanging out with the same people and getting drunk together. It's like, hey, we should give each other nicknames.
There are no assigned rules. There's no like assigned study sessions or good behavior monitors or obligated hours towards charity work or anything like that.
There are some official positions. Moose is the president. The vice president does not go out to the bars nearly as often as she did when the frat began.
I am not the best at keeping the rules, but 27 is always a magic number.
St. Jack is the god of drinking and gambling. He was a red-haired Viking with a giant mullet and mustache who had a pet chicken named Sweet Sue.
There's real talk and then there's...
sick talk.
Sick talk. Real talk is frat talk, and sick talk is real talk.
Things like calling their beer their wife, or their smokes their kids. Home is jail. And pretty much all the bars in downtown have a frat nickname. My Kamali's, for instance, is the counseling center where people get together with their wives.
The brass rail is work, and I tend bar here 5 days a week, so I was given the official title of Secretary of Labor. A boyfriend or a girlfriend is a drinking problem.
In real talk, you have your wife, which is your beer. So right now, I'm actually married to my wife. And my alcohol problem's downstairs with his wife.
You know, I'd say there's a good couple dozen members of the frat that their frat name is the name they mostly go by.
More often than not, I refer to people by their frat name.
Everybody's welcome. There's no exclusions. You just have to become friends with a couple members of the frat and have them bring you to Moose. And, you know, you have to tell Moose a little bit about yourself, and then he comes up with a frat name.
Sometimes Barney's really drunk and he's got a thing in his head and he goes, "Hey, your name is Doorknob." She's actually one of the ones that needs a name. How do you not have a name yet?
She was supposed to get one very recently.
A few years ago. Well, it never happened. It's, you know, it's a long story.
All right, you say you don't want just a random name. What should we know about you to give you a name?
I don't know. You got to ask me some questions. I have no knowledge of it before.
She's a PhD candidate for mathematics.
Stop, okay.
Okay, well then I will stop.
No, go ahead.
She's very, very beautiful, obviously.
What's your last name?
He also
her
dates me.
Her name's very, very beautiful.
My last name is Krieger, which is German for warrior.
Is it kosher to see our kids up here?
It's not kosher to discuss frat names in front of people that are getting frat names, though.
But
you can come up, but we got to talk about your name. But we can't talk about your name with you sitting there.
Go away for a little bit.
And you should go away for a little bit.
All right, but I'm taking my drink with me.
Well, no, leave your drink here.
No,
I will take care of it.
My idea is, her German name means warrior, right?
Yes.
So I was thinking Shogun.
That's a good one.
Yes.
Let's go. Right.
Omega, Omega,
Omega.
You know, to me, it's carousing with your friends at a bar is—it's not a getting drunk or a wasted thing. It's more of a group, and it's kind of like a big, close-knit family. You know.
Hail, hail, the gang's all here. What the heck do we care now?
That piece was produced by Matt Kessler. The voices you heard were Jungala, Bread, Hoss, Hooker, Double Down, Oss, Shotgun, and Moose. Members of Pi Omega Omega can be found at Mike and Molly's in downtown Champaign approximately 365 nights a year. Yeah. You're listening to Sidetrack. Many people enjoy a cold beer with a slice of pizza. For one microbrewer in St. Charles, Illinois, pizza was his inspiration. His name is Tom Seifert, and he's the creator of Mamma Mia Pizza Beer. And believe it or not, the beer is taking off. I talked with him for the August program and asked him where he got the idea for his pizza beer.
Well, you know, as a home brewer, you have the flexibility of kind of making any flavor that you want to make of beer. And the only critic is yourself. And if it's no good, you either cook with it or throw it away. We had made a beer a couple years ago with a bunch of garden herbs that turned out fairly well. In fact, it won some awards at some contests. And, again, this past Labor Day, we had some extra tomatoes. And we've kind of been kicking around something new to do with making beer. And my neighbor, he grows garlic like crazy and brought me a bag of garlic. And he kept on talking about, like, garlic beer and stuff. I'm like, I don't know. So, anyway, it was raining that day, and the weather was bad. And my wife and I were talking to each other about this crazy idea about taking tomatoes and making beer with them. My father-in-law lives in Texas, and he uses tomato juice with his beer. You know, they call it like a red eye or something like that. I don't know if you've ever heard of that before.
No, I haven't.
It's like a beer. Wow. Bloody Mary.
Okay.
So he bragged about how good it was. So we tried it one time with a regular premium beer, and it really wasn't half bad with hot sauce on it. So we figured, worst-case scenario, the beer will taste like that. All right? And so anyway, after a week in the fermenter, we racked this stuff into a secondary fermenter to let it clarify, and we usually get a sample out of it. And I drew a sample, and I tasted it, and I looked at my wife. I said, oh, my God, try this out. And no sooner did I turn around that the glass was gone. She drank the whole thing. And she's like, this is cool. It tastes like pizza and beer. So in a nutshell, we had the beginning of pizza beer.
Which is crazy, because usually people will have a pizza, piece of pizza, and a beer, and, you know, kind of let it all mix up on the inside instead
exactly.
of mixing it up beforehand.
That's exactly what we were trying to do, because a lot of people are like wine snobs, and they're like, oh, all I want to have is, I want to have my Zinfandel or my Cabernet with my pizza or my pasta or my Italian foods. And we're like, you know what, why should beer be ignored? So we went ahead and spiced the beer. You know, I mean, people don't think Blue Moon is crazy for putting oranges in beer, do they?
I guess not. Some people like that.
All right. People put lime in their Tecate and their Corona, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So why not a little basil, oregano, tomato, and garlic in your pizza
beer?
Well,
yeah, it's a little different from the fruit flavors, absolutely. But, you know, here's the thing that kind of got me. I saw some news footage of you actually brewing this stuff up.
Yes.
And in the news footage, I mean, you put in the tomatoes and the garlics and all that other stuff, but you actually dropped in a couple of slices of pizza for good effort.
That's exactly what we did for good effort. We figured for the fun of it, we may as well go ahead and dump a couple pizzas in this thing, too, and see what happens. And basically what happens is that when the pizzas went in and the spices went in, you create what we call like a cereal mash. So these pizzas were made of like wheat dough, water, yeast. There's no animal products in there. We didn't put any cheese in there. We didn't put any pepperonis, okay? We kept it all vegetarian because we wanted to be able to drink this stuff. And so when the pizzas go in to this mixture, it's in the very beginning where we're actually extracting flavors from the malt and the barley and stuff. And we'll actually take and put about 5 gallons of hot water that we'll pour on the top of that once it's sat for about an hour and the flavors get infused. And we wash all the flavors off of the grains, and the flavors from the pizza get into the whole mix. And we boil it, ferment it, and in 2 weeks you have beer.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool.
Now, has there ever been anything like this before? Like a more, I don't know, a savory type of beer? Like what you're doing, you know.
No. In fact, one of the problems we had when we were developing this beer is trying to find a resource that had made anything like this. And when we went on the internet before we even made the brew to say, okay, how do you brew with tomatoes? So I stick it in because I'm figuring some home brewer out there had to have done it. We couldn't find anything. We found a Japanese brewery who made beer with tomatoes because they wanted to make it more healthy for you. And the brewmaster was complaining about how he just couldn't stand his beer. And there were some articles about garlic in beer, but there wasn't anything about basil, oregano, or the combination of the four mentioned by anybody anywhere. So we figured, all right, if we invent this beer, we better write this recipe down. And we did. And so we're the first in the world, I think, to actually ever make a beer that is meant to be paired with a particular food or even have any sort of a food sort of flavor to it. So we're calling ourselves the world's first culinary beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you said your wife, when she first tasted it, down the glass, what other reactions have you been getting from people?
The first reaction is, you get some people who are like, they want to try everything. They're the gung-ho. They run up, and let's try this stuff. And it's everything that they expect. Then you have the people who are a little skeptical. They look at it, and they kind of hesitate. They smell it, and their eyes kind of open up. They're going, and then they start giggling because it does smell like pizza. And then when they take a sip, the reaction is usually, wow, this is unbelievable. I was expecting something that was going to taste really bad. But this has a really, really pleasant aftertaste. We've had several celebrities try our beer, and even on, well, we were on national television. We popped a bottle open on national TV in front of millions of people, and this guy that was sitting next to me, I'm going to tell you, the way that this guy is known in the business, his name is Mancow.
Yes.
Okay.
Familiar with
Mancow?
Oh, yeah, the radio personality.
Right. Mancow tried it, and he's not going to lie. If I had a harebrained idea, he's going to tell me what an idiot I am. And all he did is tell me, all he did is make the comment that I had man boobs in a rollover. So, and in fact, if later on he went up to me and said, I hope you weren't offended by that, but, if I didn't like you, I would have said a lot worse things about you than that. But he loved the beer. Another guy, Bulldog, on the East Coast, he has a big radio show. He tried it. Several celebrities in town have tried it. Even there's a celebrity chef that I won't give his name out at this time, but tried it and gave me a call and just was like, man, we got to get together, Tom. So we're in talks with several people right now about getting this thing mass-produced.
Well, honestly, you have tapped into something, and I think what you have created is the perfect guy drink.
Yes.
And, pizza and beer, that is guy food, that is guy drink, that is, total man stuff.
Yes.
Now, I guess that opens up the question, maybe there's a follow-up beer in your future. Maybe, the T-bone steak beer or the chicken wing flavored beer. Have you thought about expanding this pizza beer, strange beer empire of yours?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, you just mentioned two things. What did you say? You said T-bone?
Yeah, T-bone steak and chicken wings.
And chicken wing, right?
Yeah.
Now, imagine yourself sitting down having a big, fat T-bone steak, and you're trying to figure out what to drink with it. And all of a sudden, someone puts this beer in front of your face that's made with salsa brewed into it.
That's pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happens is that the peppers that we picked out are not, they're not the kind that are like on fire. Like some of that pepper beer, I just don't like it at all because it tastes like you've had a shot of bad whiskey. It burns your throat. And so we were really choosy and figuring out what kind of peppers to use in this thing. And then just like in a good Cabernet Sauvignon where you get that green pepper flavor to the, to the wine, this particular salsa beer has that same flavor. So you've got a good mixture of onions and peppers in the beer that go really well with the steak and hamburgers and that nature.
So what's the salsa beer called? Is it out yet?
It's called salsa beer.
Oh,
no,
okay.
It's not. That's a prototype that's going to, you asked me about follow-ups.
Okay.
And that's a prototype that we kind of followed up because that's the beer that I really wanted to do first, but pizza beer was the best mistake ever made. But anyway, the other beer you were talking about with the chicken, we were on national. We were not. We were on local television in Utica, New York, and we demonstrated how you could take the pizza beer and inject chicken fryers and roast them in an oven, which we did on a food segment on a television show up there. And then afterwards, we took our Indian-inspired beer that has curry and a number of other things in it and actually had it with the chicken. And then the owner had some chicken wings, and we did with some hot wings, and that beer goes perfect with hot wings and chicken. So we are going to try to cover all the bases on this thing.
I love it. You're making me both hungry and thirsty all at the same time. I guess all at once as well.
Cool.
So the pizza beer, it is called Mamma Mia Pizza Beer, right?
That's the name of it, yes.
And where can that be found?
People can find us right now at pizzabeer.net. The only commercial example that was made was made, I agreed to make one batch and one batch only with Walter Payton's Roundhouse. I think they may have a few bottles left in it. I know it got some really good reviews on Rate a Beer. And we don't have a contract with them to continue making it. It was just an agreement that we had to do the one batch, just, you know, as an experiment type thing. And apparently, it's done very well over there. So, I'll be looking for it very soon, because today, in fact, just as you were calling, we sent in our papers for our federal wholesale license. So we plan on. The process is that you have to get a wholesale license from the federal government, then get a state of Illinois license, and then we can begin having someone manufacture it, and we can distribute it throughout Illinois.
So soon we'll be finding it on the store shelves.
I hope before Christmas time, I hope.
Well, that's good news for all those people who want to just get the pizza and the beer all in the same gulp.
Oh, yeah. For anybody that likes to eat and drink, is going to love this stuff. And if you like to cook the pizza beer and the bread, I'll tell you what, you substitute water with pizza beer and make a French bread or a pizza dough. And we think we have actually a commercial product for the pizza industry. So if anyone out there in the pizza industry is listening and has a hankering to really spice up their pizza, our pizza beer in pizza dough is outstanding.
That was Tom Seifert, the creator of Mamma Mia Pizza Beer. You can find more about this brew on the web at mamamiapizzabeer.com. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.